This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan, and on today's show, it's all about the food. Not just any food, but what we consider really good food. Now, I don't know what it is about us journalists who report on the environment, but a lot of us have a real attachment to our victuals, getting connected with ingredients at their most basic level. Kathy, our executive producer, and her husband raised chickens in the city, and they use the fresh eggs. Kara Halsoppel and her girlfriend had a community garden plot this year, and they grew Arkansas Hill Country red okra and all sorts of other heirloom vegetables. Now, I'm not much of a farmer or even a gardener, but I'm pretty adept in the kitchen and I like good ingredients. Though I have no children or partner to feed, I once bought a 60-pound pig. You'll hear about that later in the show. We get started with Reed Frazier's account of the antithesis of the supermarket meat aisle.
You know that scene in Apocalypse Now? The one where they butcher a cow? It's actually a water buffalo, and yeah, that animal was real. If you haven't seen the movie, picture a muddy Cambodian village during the dark days of the Vietnam War. Over a bed of tripidelic music, you see a machete blade fall down on the animal's neck. The animal crumples to the ground, and villagers seen in the foreground will end up eating the animal. I've never been to a ritual sacrifice like the one I've just described. Most of the meat I've eaten has come after trips to antiseptic supermarkets, buying anonymous cuts of meat wrapped in plastic. But not long ago, I had an experience that got me just a little bit closer to the ritual slaughter depicted in that water buffalo scene. That's when I attended my first beef draft. Now, a beef draft isn't as bloody or gruesome as the scene in Francis Ford Coppola's movie. It's actually a very orderly, non-threatening way to group consume an animal. And vegetarians, you might want to cover your ears for this. In a beef draft, a cow is slaughtered and butchered. All the cuts of meat are laid out before a group of people. Each person takes a turn choosing pieces of meat until all of it is spoken for. Picture fantasy football, but with brisket. This draft was held in the house of a couple that knew a beef farmer in Ohio where they got their cow. I'd somehow gotten on an email chain about the draft a few weeks beforehand. I expressed some interest and was given a spot. The actual event was held on a rainy fall afternoon. People stood or sat in every corner of the house. Children scuttered between the adults, grabbing candy out of bowls set on the dining room table. All the meat had been shrink-wrapped and frozen. No entrails, no blood, no machetes to be found. Each of us was given a number. I was around number 30. When my name was called, I got to inspect the packets of meat laid out on the living room floor. I picked my cuts one at a time. A tiny New York strip was my first round pick. Then a series of cuts of declining stature on the meat hierarchy. Skirt steak, short ribs, and for the last four rounds, hamburger meat. Each cut was weighed and recorded by our hostess into her laptop. There was something gratifying about seeing the whole animal disappear, piece by piece, into coolers and canvas bags. We were seeing to it that no part of the animal would go to waste, and I felt that I was eating an animal that I sort of kind of knew. So when I picture the cow our family ate for months after that beef draft, I think of that water buffalo from Apocalypse Now. It fell, just like our Ohio-raised cow. But all of us in that room were there to thank it in our own harsh, human way. We would eat it, we would enjoy it, we would not soon forget it. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
When Reed Frazier's not writing up his memoirs of time spent crowded around a pile of beef, he's reporting on environmental aspects of the Marcellus Shale development for the Allegheny Front.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our...
A couple years ago, I heard that a local farmer was selling whole, whey-fed pigs to some of the area's top chefs, so I wanted one. This was a tasty form of recycling, after all. The farmer was using the byproduct of his cheese making, whey for animal feed. I was told the result was exquisitely creamy meat. But I didn't think this whole hog thing through. So when I got a call early one morning saying that a pig with my name on it had just received its death sentence, I had to scramble. My pig was just 60 pounds, small as animals go, but bigger than my freezer. Yet it was too small for the place that removed its hair and gutted it to cut it up for me. I don't own a cleaver or a big butcher's block or have the skills to cut a whole pig. The butchers that I called shunned my business because they didn't believe this was a USDA-approved transaction. When I met up with Justin Severino, the chef who ended up doing my butchering, I told him how it went on the phone with the meat markets that I'd called. He understood. They were like, "What were you thinking, young lady? You got this pig, and now what are you going to do with it? Did you think about that?" They're like yelling at me, you know.
It just, it's not geared that way, you know. It's all USDA managed, you know. And USDA is definitely systematic about what they do, and there's nowhere in their system where they support one person that buys one pig and wants to take it to a small butcher shop and get it custom butchered the way they want it.
Previously, Severino owned a high-end meat processing shop in California. He later worked on a farm in Virginia, butchering animals. For my job, a local restaurant where he was working at the time let us use their kitchen. There goes the head. Severino made short work of my pig. In a little over an hour, I had lots of vacuum-sealed freezer bags with ground pork, pork shoulder, pork shanks, on and on, and what he labeled a fun bag that included the tail and, yes, the head, pretty much intact.
Oh, it's got eyelashes.
I paid Justin around $130. Overall, my pig cost something between $3 and $4 a pound, and it was worth every penny. 4 months, okay, I'm embarrassed to say it, nearly 2 years, I've been pulling items out of the freezer, making things like fabulous fresh maple lacquered hams, simple chops, rolled stuffed belly. Just a few weeks ago, my mom made a pork ossobuco with the legs. Amazing. The piece de resistance was supposed to be the head. I made a stuffed pig's head for myself and some friends. It wasn't quite what I planned, but they were okay with it.
Cheers. Thank you.
I wish it were more flavorful.
No, I think it's very flavorful. It's interesting.
Interesting.
No, interesting is not bad.
It's basically like a hot dog. You know? I mean,
no, this is much more glamorous than a hot dog.
See, the idea was to have kind of matchstick cuts of tongue, chopped bits of ear and cheek, rolled up into the skin of the pig's head, cooked and sliced, then pan-fried with breadcrumbs. My roll, though, fell apart when I removed it from its cheesecloth wrapping, in which I'd simmered it. So I tossed everything in a food processor, shredded it up, and packed it into a patty. The whole process took some 8 or more hours over 2 days. I talked with food writer Jennifer McLaughlin about whether this was really worth it. Her latest book is called Odd Bits, How to Cook the Rest of the Animal.
Are these items getting tossed away if they're going into pet food or hot dogs or whatever? That's not a bad thing, is it? I mean, why is it important for us to work with these parts?
I really think they're too good for Fido. There's lots of tasty, delicious bits with fabulous different textures and tastes. Like, whereas the prime cuts that everyone is so obsessed with, you know, there's not a lot of difference in taste and texture, I would argue, probably between a New York cut and a ribeye.
McLaughlin says there's actually a moral responsibility to eat as much of an animal as possible once we've killed it. Unless there are some cryovac packs in the recesses of my freezer, I think I've lived up to her code. Like Edgar Allan Poe's short story, there might be a heart lurking somewhere, though. McLaughlin has an answer for that, too.
Something like a heart is extremely versatile. If you know the source of your animal, you can make kebabs, or you can even chop the heart up raw and make heart tartare, which is absolutely delicious.
Wow.
Looking back at my 2 years with my pig, I can pretty much say that I'd do it all again. Although Chef Justin Severino is getting ready to open his own restaurant, so maybe I can just stop by there. For an extended slideshow of photos from Severino's pig butchering, it's not as bad as you might think. Please go to essentialpublicradio.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating with all that meat and no potatoes. All that meat and no potatoes all that food to the alligators, yeah. Hold me steady, I am ready with all that meat and no potatoes. I don't think that...
A few years before the whole hog adventure, I visited a family that was farming unusual breeds of animals. Now, one in five livestock species is in danger of extinction worldwide. So seeing these unusual animals is like stepping into a coloring book where everything has a similar shape, but somebody made it up in shades you didn't expect, almost ruby red cattle and brick red pigs. Now we'll revisit my feature on the Smith family, and then Carol Holsapple checks back with the farmers to find out how their struggle against the livestock trend is faring. This is part of our 20th anniversary series, The Allegheny Front Rewind.
In 2007, a family in a rural town an hour from State College was in the middle of an experiment, a farming experiment. Their subjects? Heritage breeds of cows, pigs, and sheep. Jennifer Shveta Jordan visited their farm laboratory.
David Smith slides open a barn door to check on a red-brown pig, a Tamworth swine.
Maggie, you up for company?
Maggie's believed to be one of fewer than 5,000 Tamworths in the world. Compare that to popular Yorkshires, which experts say number more than a million in the U.S. alone. Because of the Tamworth's low numbers, the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy puts the breed in the class of a threatened animal.
It seems important to us to preserve a wider variety of genotypes.
There are tremendous efforts. There are, you know, seed banks, and there are germplasm, and people are freezing tissue samples for all these things, and we have them here walking around. And so it sort of kills two birds with one stone. We're able to fill our freezers and do what
we
think,
like,
I guess.
We're doing our part for keeping them going.
Yeah.
Creating demand for animal products like wool or meat is what's necessary to maintain the breeds. That's what Don Schreider says the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy is doing to keep the breeds going.
The reason all these breeds are rare is because they've lost their jobs. We look to try to find niches where the breed might be able to contribute and succeed. We're getting a huge amount of attention from chefs right now.
Jump to 2011, and the Smiths are just getting out of the heritage breed venture, at least for meat and profit. I reached Dave Smith by phone between the classes he teaches at a small college, and he explained.
We spent a lot of time very carefully establishing these breed stocks, and we got to the point where we were going to raise these things for market, and we found no market in our area. We just couldn't sell these animals either as breeders or as market animals. Feed prices just got to the point where we couldn't swing it anymore.
While higher feed prices driven by today's economy played a role, Smith says,
it was very difficult to get people to pay more than 99 cents a pound, which is what they could pay at the grocery for pork chops. I guess they just didn't see the value added of what we were producing. You know, if we had been willing to go down to State College or go to Harrisburg or go to Altoona, maybe we would have been better off.
The couple still has their original Shetland sheep herd for fleece, which is what got them into heritage breeding in the first place. And they have some of those animals butchered for themselves and friends. While their story went the way of many startup farms, they've kept a sense of humor and lots of good memories about the experience.
It was fun. It really was. But we all learned a lot. I mean, Joanna and I look back, and there's a line from Napoleon Dynamite. Napoleon comments that he has skills. You know, we have a lot of skills now. We really enjoy it when, you know, folks call up and ask questions, and we can pass on a little bit of what we learned.
Smith says they miss having their other animals, but feel relieved to move on with their lives. And he says maybe now they'll actually get to take a family vacation. For the Allegheny Front Rewind, I'm Carol Holsapple.
The Allegheny Front Rewind, a celebration of our program's 20th anniversary, is supported by the Richard King Mellon Foundation. The Allegheny Front is the region's only public radio program focused on environmental news.
One reason that certain livestock breeds have become more scarce is that over the last several decades, American consumers have sought leaner meats. Farms responded by narrowing the types of animals bred across the board, from turkeys to pigs. A Pittsburgh family-run meat packer has brought full fat back to its prosciutto so that it's more flavorful. And they've also played a small part in restoring biodiversity by using what's known as a heritage breed of hog. The Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein has this profile.
Up a set of old wooden stairs in Pittsburgh's food lover's paradise known as the Strip District is Rena Edwards' childhood bedroom.
We're going to go up first floor
right will make a right.
When Edwards was a baby, a mobile of sausages, no joke, hung over her head. Nobody lives in the building now, but still hanging from the ceiling are the family's pride and joy, handmade and naturally cured sausages and hams. There are a lot of prosciutto.
They're at different stages of aging right now. When you walk in, okay, new prosciutto, young prosciutto, prosciutto that needs to age. This is the aroma in this room. You have a young mold. Everything that is dry cured and aged in this plant is aged with mold. Americans, they don't want to see mold. They don't want to know about it. But we are so happy when you come in and you have this aroma. We know that the mold is perfect. It's curing the product. And we just continue the process.
Edwards is now president of the Parma Sausage Company. They've been curing meat in their strip district building since 1954. That's when her father, Luigi Spinabella, decided to make a business out of what had been a family tradition that has its roots in Corsica, Italy. The prosciutto she's talking about isn't an ordinary prosciutto. It comes from a Berkshire hog, which is prized for its high fat content. It adds flavor and texture that can't be found in a typical commercial hog. Rena's daughter, Erin Schumacher, elaborates.
And my dad always said, as soon as I saw the hams, I knew. And this is the hams that the old-timers I used to work with talked about. And all the good things came along with that. You know, the way they're raised, you can trace their heritage back, the marbleization of the meat, just how they're not pumped with steroids to grow them faster, or to rush anything, and they're fed a nice diet, and they're humanely slaughtered.
The Berkshire hog is a heritage breed rarely raised in the United States. Its history traces back to England, where it's been popular since the English Civil War. In America, starting in the 1950s, raising livestock changed. Most hogs aren't raised in small numbers on family farms anymore. They're grown by the thousands in factory feedlots. Because of consumer demand for the leaner meat and the need to use hogs that are able to survive confined conditions, diversity can lose out. The Berkshire hog requires more open space. Jeanette Berenger of the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy says it's important to re-expand the gene pool. And though the Berkshire and other animals don't fit into the current model that produces cheap food, they have important benefits.
The pigs tend to be a lot hardier. They're more disease resistant. You have fewer birthing problems. You have animals that can withstand a challenging environment more effectively. And, you know, we're in a world facing a global climate change, and it's these animals that are going to be able to adapt more quickly. The great thing about this adaptability is, you know, you get Mother Nature to work for you, and she works for cheap.
Finding Berkshire hogs has sometimes been a challenge for Parma sausage. Berenger cites high feed prices and access to local meat processing facilities as major impediments to expanded heritage hog rearing. Parma buys most of their hogs from the Midwest. That's because Pennsylvania farmers aren't raising Berkshire pigs in the quantity or with the consistency that the company needs. Berenger says this is something that's changing, but not very quickly.
It takes time, and slowly it's building. You know, you've got pockets of people that can produce something like that, but it's not the norm.
Parma hopes that eventually the company can buy some hogs from farms closer to Pittsburgh. On the ground floor of the building where they cure the meats, Parma has a storefront. There, a counter worker thinly slices prosciutto for waiting customers.
Take the tips of asparagus and saute them in a little garlic, yeah, and a little olive oil, quick. Mm-hmm. And wrap two stalks in a piece of prosciutto, okay, and put them in the oven with a little thin slice of like your whatever your favorite white Italian cheese is. Okay. When the cheese is melted, get it out of the oven and eat. It's unbelievable.
Thank you.
Take care, guys. Thanks for stopping in.
For Edwards, it's not just meat, but a link to the past.
Food is memory. You know, I mean, you know, the aromas that you have, like they can transport you back to these great times these people used to have. And they said they lost it because they don't do that anymore. And they would say, Rena, I thank you. This brings back my grandfather. This is the taste that I used to have when I was a kid growing up.
Edwards is passing on those memories and a tradition of heritage to a new generation. As I leave, she is about to sit down to a plate of the family's prosciutto with her grandchildren. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Hal B. Klein.
Much of today's Allegheny Front looks at taking a step back in the food world, experiencing a way of doing things that's no longer common but may have certain environmental benefits. Now here's an example of a way of shipping turkeys that certainly is a throwback, but it's hard to imagine the benefits other than comic relief. Before modern-day shipping technology, at Thanksgiving time at the turn of the 20th century, herds of turkeys had to travel to markets by foot, sometimes hundreds at a time. On a West Virginia University website, you can see a photo of scads of live turkeys in the middle of an unpaved main street, and it is quite a sight. On today's show, food writer Fred Sossman interviews a Tennessee County official about the long-lost practice of turkey driving in Appalachia.
We don't think much nowadays about how turkeys get from farm to market to oven, but from around 1884 to 1920, in rural, mountainous Hancock County, Tennessee, it was quite an undertaking. Imagine moving hundreds of turkeys 35 miles over rugged land and rough water. Imagine keeping track of which turkeys are yours and which belong to your neighbor. Imagine what happens at evening roosting time when the turkeys take control and head for the trees. Imagine your disappointment when, at the end of that long turkey trek, you don't get the price you'd hoped the birds would bring. Scott Collins of Sneedville isn't old enough to remember the legendary turkey drives of his home county, but he has studied the strange practice as much as anyone. After a 32-year career as a court administrator, he now negotiates business loans for Citizens Bank of East Tennessee in Sneedville. On his office wall is a photograph taken, he thinks, around 1912. It depicts dozens of turkeys on the grounds of the Hancock County Courthouse about to be driven in the direction of the Clinch River.
Hundreds of turkeys would be gathered here in front of the courthouse, and they would drive these turkeys to Morristown and to Rogersville to sell them. They would drive those turkeys down the river, and they'd put those few turkeys up on that raft and pull them to the other side. Of course, somebody would still there with them, and then they'd pull the raft back and take a few more over. This went on until they got them all on the other side of the river. Then at that time, there was no road. There was just a path down through there, and they would lead these turkeys down approximately 2, maybe 3 miles, and then they would continue on the path to Morristown. If dark came, I guess the turkeys decide where they want to roost for the night, and that's where they'd have to stop.
After all that labor and hardship, Scott says the turkey herders were totally at the mercy of the buyers in Morristown and Rogersville. Sometimes the farmers got the price they expected, oftentimes they did not. But they couldn't turn back and had to accept the offer. Although the turkey drives seem humorous from the perspective of the 21st century, Scott says they were typical of the extremes people in the mountains had to go to in order to survive.
Back then, that was their way of actually making some money to feed their families, especially at Christmas time. The people in this area had it tough. Today, I consider it very humorous, even thinking about it. My goodness, if you're talking about hundreds of turkeys, wouldn't that be something?
Improved transportation and probably accumulated fatigue ended the turkey drives. Scott Collins says people today have a hard time believing the drives ever occurred, but they did, and that photograph of soon-to-be herded turkeys searching the ground for food in front of the Hancock County Courthouse in Tennessee is proof.
Thanks to West Virginia Public Broadcasting and Tennessee-based food writer Fred Sossman for that interview with Scott Collins, who's studied the turkey drives. Now we compare a much earlier past and present. Commentator and hobby farmer Ken Kiakia tells us how a growing appreciation for his barnyard birds has awakened a childhood fascination with their ancestors.
I picked up the phone. It was Heather, our neighbor from up the hill. "Your turkeys have been digging up my garden again," she said. "We have a wedding planned next month. Could you do something about keeping them off our yard?" I was mortified. My wife and I are now 3 years into our grand experiment as hobby farmers. We've been able to give free range to a barnyard full of creatures, chickens, ducks, guinea fowl, even goats, none of whom seem to need to roam outside our 26 acres. The stock dogs do help keep the goats in line. The only beasts to get us into trouble with the neighbors, for some reason, have been adolescent turkeys. Once they mature, they're not too bad. The toms, at least, spend most of their time kicking the living daylights out of each other, the hens watching appreciatively. But young turkeys always seem to have a wild oats period, involving stealing Christmas lights, pooping on Weber grills. We moved this year's young turkeys into a fenced area. The neighbor's wedding was saved, and harmony reigns in Harmony, Pennsylvania. Still, I miss walking with them. One of the surprises of farm fowl ownership for us has been that they form such complex and interesting little societies. They have a little avian metropolis going, and one or other of the hens will occasionally stop from her busy schedule to commiserate, clucking urgently about how that other hen bit her, and that the new cockerel has been a little rough with the girls and might serve a higher calling as a friar. I have a feeding and watering routine every morning, and they've learned its rhythms, and will follow along with me eagerly as I gather, fill, and distribute feeders full of grain. The young turkeys are really good-looking birds. These aren't those bloated, white, job-of-the-hut turkeys that you get from the grocery store, but sleeker heritage breeds that have more than a passing resemblance to wild turkeys. When I first heard the line that dinosaurs survive as today's birds, it seemed preposterous. But I get it now. Today, journal papers on dinosaurs tend to include the term non-avian dinosaur, because now you have to specify that. As I walk with our birds, I imagine myself walking with small raptors. Dromaeosaurus, to be technical. Maybe a pack of little butyraptors. I'm safe only because I'm a bit too big for them to take down. Doesn't hurt that they know I'm about to feed them. I've loved dinosaurs all my life. At the age of 7, I'm told, I gave an impromptu lecture next to the Tyrannosaur in the Museum of Natural History in Manhattan. And the young turkeys' movements are so much like little feathered dinosaurs. You can just see how they must have looked, moving through the vegetation. In the turkeys' curiosity, their willingness to go off and get into trouble with the neighbors, you can see the teamwork, the intelligence. Don't let anybody tell you birds are dumb. People just don't pay enough attention to them. In September, a paper in the journal Science reported the first ever dinosaur-era feathers preserved in amber. In addition to the hair-like primitive feathers, the researchers found one suitable for flight and even for an aquatic lifestyle, and a number of intermediate forms. They could even see the pigmentation. The Mesozoic era, it turns out, was colorized and plumed.
Allegheny Front commentator Ken Kiakia lives and celebrates the holidays among rabbits, goats, and assorted dinosaurs in Harmony, north of Pittsburgh. Thanks for listening to our program, Chickens and Dinosaurs and All. Please remember to like us on Facebook. We're on a turkey trot toward 1,000 likes against our news partner's Pipeline. To easily get to our Facebook page, you can go to the Facebook icon from our website, AlleghenyFront.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, or get some turkey to carry your mail to 67 Bedford Square, Pittsburgh 15203. The Allegheny Front is produced at Pittsburgh's 91.3 FM WYEP. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Our production director is Joey Spihar. Ann Murray is our senior producer and editor and favorite person to feed around the office. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front. Bon appetit!
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments, Colcom Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of forest health and Marcellus shale issues.